So welcome to this week's edition of the Excellence in Training Academy, where trainers come to grow. I'm very pleased to have with us this week Jamie Gaduri. Jamie is a former workaholic who is learning to prioritize what matters most. He considers himself a disciple of Jesus, and is okay that that seems odd to some. He's a husband to an amazing wife, Amy, and a father to three smart, energetic children. He has been learning, practicing, and teaching leadership for over 20 years and wonders how often success and failure are conjoined twins. As an Army infantry officer, he experienced the challenges of crisis management and operating with ad hoc teams, including in Afghanistan in 2002. In 2006, he commanded a rifle company in Ramadi, Iraq, during the surge as part of a task force that broke the back of Al-Anbar insurgency and earned the cooperation of local nationals. He was influential in negotiating and partnering with tribal leaders, and at one point earning the droll title Sheikh Gaduri. His company partnered with Iraqi Army, established Iraqi police stations, rebuilt local infrastructure, established local governance, and neutralized an enemy sniper who had been wreaking havoc. He's thankful for the many innovative and adaptive and resilient leaders and soldiers who accomplished so much in such a short time. Jamie spent 6 years in the human capital development and talent management industry. His experience includes project and program management, curriculum development, creation of multimedia, case studies, executive coaching, hiring panel consultation, developmental workshops, and longitudinal organizational interventions. He worked for several years with the Center for the Army Profession and Ethic, helping them train and develop numerous tiers of leadership in ethical decision-making and professional identity. Meaningful experiences included producing a documentary on war crime and whistleblowing, serving as a facilitator for a suicide prevention program, and impacting a team that was navigating an existential crisis. Jamie enjoys learning of all kinds. Prior to West Point, he spent a year learning biblical languages and studying psychology and philosophy. At West Point, he studied civil engineering and earned a degree in individual psychology and participated in a variety of sports, including rugby, boxing, and basketball. While there, he graduated from the Army Special Operations Combat Diver Course in Key West and Mountain Warfare Course in Alaska. After graduation, he completed Ranger School, where he later instructed, Airborne School, Jumpmaster School, the Expert's Infantryman's Badge, and a course in the Dynamics of International Terrorism. He is currently pursuing a graduate degree full-time while continuing to consult. So, Jamie, welcome to the Excellence in Training Academy.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
So I asked you to come on today to talk about some our profession and a philosophy that you have and that you teach about warriors and guardians keeping our profession. So maybe what we can start with is let's start by talking about profession and being a professional. So can you talk a little bit about what it means to be a professional?
Yeah, absolutely. A number of years ago, I was able to, through a company I was working with at the time called the Previous Group, work with the center that the Army's established to really think through and to educate the force on what it means to be a profession and an Army profession. And that really helped my thinking develop, because even though I'd been part of the Army for a number of years, well over a decade at that point in time, I really don't know that I saw myself fully as part of a profession. That wasn't something that was always in my thinking. We would have discussions about professionalism and being professional in terms of, you know, uniform, having a crisp uniform, shiny boots, making sure that you have what we call military bearing and conducted yourself in a way that was considered professional. But this deeper, more core idea of being part of a profession, everything that came with that is kind of a holistic view of what we did, was not really part of my vocabulary. So for your question of what does it mean to be a professional, I think it goes beyond some of those surface level things. I think first it starts off with really understanding your identity as a professional, what that means, the organization that you're part of. In this case, with this audience, law enforcement, being part of a profession that serves society in that way. it's being part of something that is much greater than yourself, and having that awareness, and having that awareness in a way that actually filters down to your daily work. I think with it comes this obligation for self-development. And I know with the work that you're doing here with trainers, that's a big focal point of beyond what's required of me for the particular job that I'm in or duty position or role that I'm in at this moment in time. I've got this imperative to develop myself. And I think that's one of the quintessential things of what it means to be a professional. How am I going to improve? How will I grow over time? And hand in hand with that is this obligation to develop others. How am I going to see others in my profession, whether they're junior members of the profession, or my peers, or even sometimes those who are above me? How can I always have this mindset that I'm going to be a person that develops others into this core profession that we're part of? And I think in all of that, there's just this sense of ownership that goes far beyond the daily tasks of life, a sense of ownership that this is mine. Yes, I'm part of this profession, but it's mine, and I'm always on the alert to make it better. Those are some of the things I think that it means to be a professional.
Excellent. And as we get into the discussion today, we're going to talk more about identity, but some great points there about being part of something greater than yourself, which is something that applies to both the law enforcement and the military. But I think that we're seeing that people as a whole want to be part of something greater than themselves. And I really like when you talk about the being a professional is that obligation to self-development and to that obligation to develop others, and taking that sense of ownership, that sense of responsibility. I think what we see is too often people are pointing the finger and saying it's somebody else's responsibility, where if we all take that sense of ownership, we can make a significant changes in a short period of time. So what are some of the distinguishing features then of a profession?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think kind of at the outset, it's understanding that a profession may share some attributes with occupations or jobs, and certainly there's things that we look for in members of a profession or in a profession that we might see in other jobs that exist in society. But when we look at a kind of some stricter definitions of a profession, there's some things that really come to light that a profession is just that much farther ahead in those ways. And what I'll share is largely adapted from the Army's publication ADRP-1, that's Alpha Delta Romeo Papa 1, entitled The Army Profession, put out by U.S. Department of Defense. And also through some of the work of Dr. Don Snyder, who's one of the fellows on that topic for the Center for the Army Profession Ethic. But in terms of distinguishing features, what we look at is the unique and vital service, right? So it's this something that you cannot do for yourself. And the way that I've had heard it described in the past was, in choosing a surgeon, and this has become a bit more personal over the last months as my dad has gone through a major cardiac surgery and kind of coming through that. When you think about that, in that moment of seeing my dad go into the operating room for something that's just amazing, that we as humans have been able to develop this ability to operate on a person's heart and to pump their blood and their oxygen through external machinery, kind of shut everything down in terms of body systems for this period of time, do the repairs that are needed, and then bring someone back up out of that. That's a very unique and a very vital service that none of us who end up needing something like that can perform for ourselves. And so when we think about the military, when we think about law enforcement, society expects to have a service performed that at the end of the day they can't do for themselves. And when I think about it in law enforcement, I just think of the very simple pressing of three digits on the phone pad for 911. And that at the no matter what people may say about law enforcement, no matter whether I don't like getting speeding tickets or kind of on the lighter side to some of the more deeper and hard discussions that are being had right now about law enforcement and communities, at the end of the day, we still know how to dial 911. And it's because we now need and expect a unique and vital service that we cannot do for ourselves. And tied in with that is this idea of expert knowledge. There's knowledge of the tasks and the technical aspects of the profession that there's an expertise. It's an expert knowledge that goes far beyond. You know, I have friends who are you know, who own guns, who are gun owners. They go to the range, and they enjoy that. And you know, some of them are you know, probably pretty good. But when it comes down to that, when we look at the military or law enforcement in particular, some of the specialized parts of law enforcement, that specific knowledge has to be expert, has to be well beyond what the average person might have. And ballistics and shooting is just one small example, but there's this package of expert knowledge that the profession holds and develops and then passes on to its younger generations and to others as they kind of grow. Wrapped up in that is this trust relationship with the client. And in this case, it's you know, with law enforcement and with society. And to me, that's really the distinguishing feature of the profession, because everything else really pivots on that. If I don't trust a doctor, I'm not going to go to that doctor. If there's something that's come up in his history, if there's something in even the relationship itself, I'm going to choose to go to a different doctor. And it's critical that trust relationship with the client, with society, continue to be developed. Then we have self-policing. Professions police themselves. Usually there's some form of an ethical code or expected behaviors or expected ways of doing business that particular profession is charged with holding on to and charged with, when a member violates it, with coming back and saying this was out of bounds. And we are going to take care of the discipline and everything else that needs to go with this. And then all that leads to the autonomy that the profession itself has. It operates separate from society in a sense. It operates separate from its client to kind of do that growth of knowledge, that maintenance of its ethic, that self-policing. That's done separately, out of the view of society to a large extent. And it's expected to operate with that autonomy and expected to operate with that trust.
Excellent. And some great points. And that expert knowledge piece really ties into what you talked about being a professional, about that obligation to self-development, to continue to grow, continue to improve, to continue to develop that expert knowledge and that skill and that expertise in these unique and vital services that we provide. So there's that responsibility on us to, as you said, to hold that, to develop that, and then to pass that on. And I think that's critical as well. Now, the where you talked about the trust relationship with the client and self-policing, I'm assuming that there's a very strong link between that if we're not doing the self-policing part of being a profession, that it's going to have a negative impact on that trust relationship. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. And I think it's, you know, when we look at kind of this modern era that we're in and where technology has advanced, I mean, you see this. You see this in the military as some of the war crimes came to light and society's reaction to that, and really the global reaction to that. You see this right now as there's issues that the public and law enforcement are dealing with in terms of police shootings, in terms of race relations and so on, that regardless of where, if you will, the fault may lie, even the perception that there's an issue with either the self-policing or with the expertise or so on, when that comes to light, just as with any other profession, that starts to erode the trust. And so there's got to be this consistency between the reality in terms of how we're building that expertise, in terms of how we're doing the self-policing, and then what's perceived by the public. And it can break down really anywhere in that continuum, if you will.
Absolutely. And I think one of the cautions that we have to consider right now with law enforcement is this knee-jerk reaction, where we've seen in certain places where there's this overreaction and we're taking action to try and appease people rather than doing thorough, competent investigations. When we make a mistake, when we screw up, when we do something wrong, we need to stand up and own up to that. But we need to, it goes back to those trust relationships. And if we develop the trust with the client, with the community, then they will trust us to give us the time to do those thorough, competent investigations. Can you talk a little bit more about that trust? Because it's obviously a huge, huge issue right now, something that we're facing. Can you talk about, you obviously, when you were in the military, when you were in Iraq, you developed that trust with the communities that you were there, with the community leaders, and were able to accomplish tremendous things. So based on all of your work and your leadership experiences, what are some recommendations or things that you would advise the law enforcement profession to do right now to help develop that trust relationship?
Yeah, Brian, I think you really hit it on the head with that in terms of when an organization, when a department has that relationship with the community, then they're kind of given that And you talk about how some of that worked out for me over in Iraq, and it's funny when we talk in our household now about having you know, what meat should we have for this occasion, and my family knows that I kind of have a knee jerk reaction to having anything like lamb or similar, just because of all of the different ways that I enjoyed those meals over in Iraq. And that was like a key part of getting our mission done, right? It was of sitting down at length, having these lengthy meals as part of that culture, as we were working with Sunni tribes in in that part of Iraq, in Al Anbar province. So you're sitting down there and spending all this time, and really, I just want to come and I just want to have this conversation with you and get this task done and move on to the next thing. But I know that over these next months and setting things up for the next years, that if this is going to be successful, it means sitting down and investing this time literally across the table or across the meal from you, having these conversations, building relationship, and then talking business, if you will. And then it's not just a one and done, right? It's something that's built over time. And so that's what played out for my unit, for myself, for others who I worked with, as we worked with tribal leaders, folks who honestly were either working very hard when we first got there, working very hard, or at least allowing attacks, on our forces. And we really had to start changing, in that case, the very fundamental nature of the relationship, right? Going from people who wanted to kill me and my men when we arrived there to changing and saying, we're going to change the dynamic of this. And obviously, yeah, there was a kinetic component to that, right? There was a component of how do we, when we are involved in a gunfight, how do we win it well? But then there was this, if you will, hearts and minds aspect of it, where we're developing relationships, listening to what the needs of the community were. You know, so if I come to the negotiating table or I come to the dinner saying, hey, we need to get this and this done in order for the security of our forces or for the progress of the mission, and they say, well, you know what, I can't even get access to the graveyard that's across the street to pay respect to my father and grandfather, and this is like one of the leaders in a very personal way appealing, can I just get over there to visit the grave? And it had been cut off because of where some of the security lines were. Wow, a request like that is so far outside of like what we would have normally been thinking, right? As American forces there, as coalition forces there, trying to accomplish a mission. But a request like that, when it's responded to, it creates this goodwill, it creates relationship that now, as we have more and more of those instances, we can start working together. And so I think with any community, with any groups of people, this key part is just listening. What is it that the other side is saying, or the person on the other side of this table, what is it that they need? What are they asking for? Because honestly, Brian, most of us, we come into conversations, we've got our agenda, we've got our perspectives, our paradigms of looking at things, and it takes a lot of discipline to sit there and say, I'm actually going to listen to and try to understand what it is that you're saying so that now I can try to meet some of the needs that you're expressing at the table.
Some great points there, and I just want to go back and build on some of these things because you made some really, really great points that I think we as a profession need to listen to. You talked about the fact that we need to build relationships, then talk business, and I think right now what we're doing is we want to, as you said, we want to go in, we're driven, we're task-driven, we just want to go in and talk business. We're frustrated that people don't want to pay attention to the truth, don't want to pay attention to the facts, don't want to pay attention to what the research shows. But when you talk about hearts and minds, there's a reason why hearts is before minds, that we need to establish that relationship at the heart level. They need to know that we care about them. They need to know that we're interested in their concerns and their hopes and dreams and fears. They need to know that we're willing to invest the time to make this a long-term relationship before we can get to the mind piece and start to build some of these solutions. And like you said, the key is listening. So what are some things that you would advise people to do to step back from, other than what you've already talked about, to step back from our desire to just want to go in and talk solutions right away and talk facts? Are there other things that you did to reach the hearts and minds, but starting with the heart and building those relationships?
Yeah, the time period when I was in Iraq, to kind of use that as a specific example, was we're full steam ahead with the counterinsurgency operations, using General Petraeus's kind of doctrine, if you will, that was being implemented at that time, and you know, the surge happened, and you know, some great results. And one of the core parts of that was to obviously, in that sense, in that context, security is first, right? You can't, if you don't have security, if you're not able to if you will, guard a particular location or particular people from an attack, it's hard to provide them with services or to provide other things while you're literally under attack, right? So security was always first. But then what we started to do, and what the units around me, the units above me, what just kind of a core part of the operation was to go in, yes, attacking enemy where enemy was, but then immediately following that with humanitarian aid, with food for some of the areas that needed food. And I just remember some of the preparations for operations where there was the timing between it was literally immediate. So as soon as we get through here and deal with this threat that's over here, we're going to find ways to meet the needs, whether it was medical needs, like I mentioned, food needs, whether it was schools, and so on. Like, what is it that affects the daily lives of these people that we're really asking to partner with us, and really to partner with us at risk to themselves, right? And there were some definite stories out of that, of where people who aligned with us exposed themselves to risk. Some of them had, you know, family members murdered as a result. So there's a very real risk. So you're thinking through this mindset of what is it that they need in daily life, what's important to them that makes it, if you will, worth the effort, right? Worth the effort to partner with me. Why are they even going to sit down at this at the table with me? How can I meet some of these needs? You know, some of it was just if cultural sensitivity. You know, so we would receive training just on how you know, the folks in the Sunni parts of Iraq, just how they interacted, what some of the customs were, what some of the implications of the religious beliefs there were, and really trying to understand the people that we were going to meet. And so there were just some very real, you know, outcomes to that in terms of you know, shaking hands, in terms of one of the things that's always stuck with me is of just taking off the sunglasses, you know, and of course we wear sunglasses for eye protection, both from sun, but also for ballistic. But when you're getting into that meeting, I've got to take those glasses off so that when I'm looking at someone in the eye, they can see that I'm looking them in the eye. I remember one advisor saying, you know, you've got to take that outer layer of skin off. You know, we've got all this body armor on, and we walk into a house trying to have a conversation with someone. Sometimes it means just taking that off. Let them see the humanity. I'm human just like you are, and we're going to sit down and we're going to have this conversation. And so kind of an answer to your question in terms of what the law enforcement community can do, I would say in any conversation, it's finding those strands of common humanity. What are the ways that I can make myself sometimes vulnerable to you who I'm talking to? How can I make myself really evident as a fellow human being? How can I show the respect that I have for your customs? You know, one of the big things for us in that environment was if you had to take in a tribal leader or an elder to detain them for one reason or another, you didn't do it in front of family members. You didn't do it in a violent way that caused them to lose, the term was WASTA, to lose that respect in front of members of their family. And so you found other ways to do things so that you could show respect to the people that you were working with. And those are just some of the very tangible things that we did.
And that's some great information, and it goes back to what we talked about a number of times in a number of these interviews, is the power of unconditional respect and showing respect for people and treating people with dignity and respect. And as you said, learning about the community rather than assuming that we know what they want, assuming that we know what they need, because we're very good at assuming, but we're not always good at just asking about what is it that you need, because sometimes what we assume is going to be important to them may not be important. Is that something that you found in some occasions?
Yeah. And you know, sometimes it was clear, right? Like everybody wants things to be more secure. So some of those things, you know, the assumptions were valid, but you know, in other instances, like, you know, for instance, like the graveyard example that I gave, I mean, that's, no one could have predicted that, right? Until actually having the conversation, no one would have predicted sitting there on a map, sitting there looking at some charts that, you know what, I bet the thing that's really burning on this community leader's heart right now is that he just wants to go visit his family, you know, visit their graves. I don't know that anyone at the table was thinking that, but when you actually go in and have that conversation, okay, now I can understand what the issues are for you. You know, I can remember leaders saying, hey, I just want access to be able to go get my supply of dates out of the storage unit that I have it in, because I need to be able to be able to sell them. Otherwise, they're all going to rot and I'm going to lose that investment. So I just need access to the dates at that particular corner. And because you guys are in the area, I can't get there. So you've got all of these, like, these requests and needs that are just, until you have the conversation, you're not going to know it. Some things are predictable, right? Some things, you know, the basic necessities of life and education, and you can kind of predict a general trajectory of where a conversation might go. But until we have that specific conversation, like, what is it that you really need? We're not going to know. We're not going to know with finality.
And that's a great point, that we need to have that conversation, develop those relationships, and find out what it is that the community needs so that we can serve that. And again, it goes back to that power of unconditional respect and that common humanity, and putting a human face on, for us, on law enforcement to help to break down some of these barriers. Now, you talk about identity. So can you talk a little bit about the role of identity in driving performance, both personally and professionally? And maybe talk about what you mean by identity, and then what's the role of identity in driving performance?
Yeah, I think it's great. One of the colleagues that I worked with in some of the projects for the U.S. Army, Professor Joe LaBeouf, who's a professor down at Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. And he used to talk about identity being a secret weapon. And sometimes we wondered if that was hyperbole, like, what's, like, is it really a secret weapon? But there's some real, like, truth to that when you unpack it and think about, like, what is the strength of knowing who I am, right? And that's not just who I am in this role, but who I am as a person, both in a profession, but as a family member, as a part of society. And I think it is powerful. When we think about I think there's probably three ways that identity really helps in driving performance. The first is probably narrative. And culture right now talks a lot about narrative, is like, what's the story that's unfolding? What's the story that's being told? And I think at a very personal level, when you think about the story, like your own individual story, my own individual story, to understand who I am in that story and to understand how that story is unfolding is pretty important, as well as the bigger story that's taking place. What's the bigger story that I'm part of? And for me as a Christian and as a veteran, knowing some of those particulars is a big deal, of knowing the bigger part, you know, my life, of what's God's story, what's my story that's within that. As a veteran, being part of some organizations that have rich histories going back through, you know, through the world wars or even farther back from that, and understanding what's been done before me in this particular place or in this particular unit, what's come before, what's going to come after, and just having that overall narrative, both very personal and organizational, of the story that's unfolding. Then I think it gives direction and organization just to all of the various things that we're doing. Right? Like if we looked at anyone's particular calendar or schedule of daily events, a lot of busyness to it, a lot of maybe even disparate efforts going on, a lot of different tasks. And when I truly understand who I am within the organization, who I am as a professional, that gives kind of this umbrella over all of those tasks, so that it gives good perspective to them. And I think about the fable that's told about the medieval bricklayer or stone worker who's sitting there with just this pile of stones, carrying them day in and day out and cutting them to fit exactly, and a very tedious, very grueling type of work, you know, and two of them side by side, and one of them, you know, is asked, what are you doing? Well, I'm hauling bricks, or I'm hauling stone. And then the other one, what are you doing? Well, I'm building a cathedral. And that story may be familiar to many of the trainers listening, but I think it's profound, even though it may be well used. It's this idea of, what is it that's bigger than me that's going on? What is it that I'm part of that gives meaning to all of these tasks that in a moment they may actually be boring, they may be stressful, they may be distasteful, like, why am I doing this? But when we start to like go up to the big picture, we truly understand, okay, this is the significance. I had a professor that talked about doing that in a church setting and in a work setting, to help folks who are in the medical profession to understand just how important what they were doing was in the grand scheme, and how they were reflecting part of God's character. And he talked about a particular either company or hospital that was taking a very proactive approach to reach down all the way to, if you will, the lowest positions in that hospital, to say, okay, if you're the person that comes in and are doing the janitor jobs to clean and sterilize this room, we could allow you to look at your job as just a janitor, or we could invite you to realize your role in protecting that particular patient who comes to the hospital from getting secondary infections, of how you are critical to making sure that this patient is protected in this holistic sense of what's happening inside a hospital, inside that medical profession. Your role in this is actually critical and is right on par with the person who's actually conducting surgery. And so this organization was elevating the thinking of the people in the organization to say, your identity, you're part of this bigger thing that's going on. And so your daily tasks that may be, even in that case, distasteful, are critical to ensuring that, in this sense, the mission is accomplished. You know, going back to that idea of dialing 911, I think that when we start to think that way, we see our identity as it is, that's very motivating. Like, what is actually happening when a citizen dials 911? And I know from talking with friends and colleagues of mine who are in law enforcement, sometimes those are all just frivolous calls. But at the end, it's showing this amazing trust and dependence to say, I need help, and I'm calling to see if you can help me. And that kind of a perspective, I think, can be very, very motivational.
Excellent. And again, some great elements of that narrative. And we need to pay attention to that narrative. What story are we telling ourselves? And are we telling ourselves that I'm just hauling bricks, I'm just writing tickets, I'm just doing this, I'm just answering calls for service, or do we understand our role in the bigger picture? And again, it goes back to what you talked about with being a professional, and we're part of something bigger than ourselves. And that's such a critical piece. What you talked about is, that being part of a bigger picture, a bigger story, but that narrative is critical. We need to be cautious of false narratives, but we need to really understand who we are and how we fit into all of this, and how we serve. And trainers, I think, are critical piece in that, because trainers will never know how many lives they've changed, how many lives they've saved, but it's staggering the number of people that are alive today because of great training. And so you said there was three ways that identity affects performance. Narrative was the first one, is that correct?
Yeah, it was narrative, and then what I would call either direction or organization, just being able to tie together all of the disparate parts of what I'm doing. And then the last would be motivation. And just as I get up in the morning, do I understand, as I'm going into work within my profession, this can actually motivate me to do better, to endure when things look dark, because I kind of see that big picture. I see how I tie into that very specific way.
Can you talk more about that? Because it had to be challenging for you when you were in Afghanistan and Iraq. You're losing friends. You're losing soldiers that you're responsible for. And we're seeing this right now in law enforcement, where we're seeing these attacks on the profession. We're seeing the profession being profiled. We're seeing these constant attacks in the media. And it's challenging for some people to get up in the day and at the start of the day confronted with all that negativity and remember the true mission. So what are some advice or some tips you can give people around that motivation piece?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess really, Brian, I've got to say at the outset that I did not always do it well. In fact, there were plenty of times I did it poorly and got sucked into just the daily grind, and then allowing that to impact me. And of course, you are impacted, right? When you're having these things happen, when you've just got that drudgery, it weighs you down. So first, I would say I definitely did not always do it right. What I could do is give you a couple examples of where of actually the actions of other people serve to really bolster my morale or just give motivation. One of those that comes to mind was actually right after my first deployment, which was to Afghanistan. And after 6 months in Afghanistan, eager to get home, and we load the plane, we're flying back, and those flights back, they're always stopping somewhere, sometimes in Europe, sometimes in Asia to get back, usually in Europe. And our flight was going to stop in Shannon, Ireland, for a refuel. And it was this big piece of morale when the operations officer got on the intercom system and said, okay, everybody can have two beers, two beer limit. Of course, we've been dry for 6 months. So, instant injection into morale. But what I remember as we walked back onto the airplane, the way that particular airport was structured, there were these probably plexiglass partitions between different loading areas. And as we walked back down to reload our plane, I remember looking over, and there was a flight of Americans who were also on a layover. And as they looked and watched us march on, they just spontaneously just broke into this loud applause. And in that moment, you've been serving for 6 months, in a pretty dismal part of the world, pretty dirty part of the world, pretty dismal. And to have that kind of a reconnection with the people that you're serving, and to see the gratitude, the care that they had, the honor and the respect that was coming, it made an impact on me. It was a very cool experience. I think the challenge lies in looking forward to when that moment may come, or into believing that there are people who are very, very grateful. There are people that absolutely support and respect everything that you're doing on a daily basis. I bumped into an officer about a week ago in a coffee shop, and just said, just said that simple thank you that I, as a military veteran, have so often received. And then we started chatting, and he had a military background as well at one point, but he kind of agreed that he's not always getting the thank you. It's often the dirty looks. And so I think remembering that there are the people that just want to stand there and applaud what you do despite all these other things that are going on. Sometimes it's just that discipline of knowing it and believing it, and then when something like that happens, of kind of treasuring that away. Another is where I can remember long into our Iraq deployment. I remember my commander talking to a group of us, and I don't remember the exact timeline. We were probably maybe a month out or so from redeploying, and of course, as you start to get that close on a 15-month deployment, you get within a month, it's almost like you're even more on edge because, you know, some of the tragedies you see someone, you know, dying like the day before going back home. And it's like, man, you don't want that to happen. You don't want that to happen, obviously, to yourself or the people around you. But it's almost being more on edge of just, man, let's just see this through to the end honorably and also making sure we're protected. So the stress level kind of goes up. And I remember him just talking and setting our minds forward a month, like fast forwarding and saying, okay, where are you going to be, you know, 35 days from now? What is it that you're going to be doing? And during that kind of, you know, dismal, you know, time in the deployment cycle of just painting that picture. And I think that's something that we can do for ourselves and then for other people of painting that more positive picture, something that can pull you out of this moment that you're in. That's just got so much more meaning and a positive tone to it, or finding those people that are encouraging in that way. So that's just a couple of examples of how to do it. I mean, it's hard, right? It's hard when you're in that grind, and I think it takes discipline. It takes finding other people that want to think in this, if you will, higher way, and then it's reminding one another of that.
And some great examples and great points. And I think we in law enforcement do not do a good job of focusing on the positive. We have a tendency to watch the 6 o'clock news too much, which we should probably stop doing, because there's a small group of very vocal people that dominate that, and we believe that they speak for the greater population. Yet all of the polls that have been done in the last few years show that the majority of people in our communities trust the police, believe in the police, and we need to share those stories. We need to share those positive stories with each other, where we tend to discount those and focus on the negative. And like you said, we need to paint that different picture. We need to reconnect with the people that we're serving and realize that the majority of those people in our communities respect the police, they trust the police, and we need to continue to build on that and be very cautious of this us versus them mentality. So some great points. Now, I know what you talk about, and you actually have a course or a class that you teach through the Virtus Group about warriors and guardians keeping our profession. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because these terms have created this kind of polar discussion within law enforcement, where some people say, well, you can't use the word guardian or can't use the word warrior. You have to use the word guardian, and the warriors come up with a very negative context. And there's other people say they're not exclusive terms. So can you talk a little bit about the two terms and how they're interwoven?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things really that I want to do with even that title is to excite, because I know that it is polarizing. And when we talk about being a profession, when we enter into conversations as experts in our craft, experts in our profession and what we do, we should go boldly into those conversations. I think they're healthy. Now, I don't think it's necessarily healthy to then just everybody spins off to their polar opposites and stays there and never moves. But I think it's good to come in and have this rich debate, this rich discussion about this versus that, and in this case, versus being a warrior versus being a guardian. And the desire would be that people then kind of come to a better understanding of the other side and have a being richer because of the debate. So really, for the purposes of the course, I want to use it as a lead-in, as kind of to bring people into that conversation and in a very professional way, because that is exactly what professions should do, is debate this. So I don't want to take too hard of a stand one way or the other on warrior versus guardian and perhaps give it away. But I would say, you know, in my mindset from the outside of your profession looking in, I do see there being balance between them and. You know, I'm probably slightly biased towards the idea of guardian. You know, the whole everything that's wrapped up in protect and serve connotes that. But for me, there's a time when that warrior switch needs to turn on. And particularly as we look at post 9/11 and active shooter North America, I'm kind of saying those two things separately, post 9/11, but then also this just active shooter kind of environment that we're in now. You know that there are going to be times when that warrior needs to kick on. One of the examples that, you know, I wasn't anywhere near it, but it was about 25, 30 miles down the road from where I lived and worked in Texas at the time. But when we had the Fort Hood shootings, and obviously, you know, personal to me just in the sense of, being a veteran. But other than that, you know, not a real, connection, except just being there. And in that moment, when you have an active shooter who arguably for, an ideology, for terrorist ideology is killing, literally defenseless service members. In that moment, when a police sergeant shows up, yeah, she's performing the role of guardian. But in that moment when she is moving to the sound of the guns, as we would say it, and going to actively eliminate the threat, you know, Kimberly Munley in that moment became a warrior, or in that moment had flipped the switch to being a warrior. And I would hope for that. I would want that when those situations arise, when those who protect our communities, when those who are our guardians flip into that, that warrior mindset, I hope that they do that well. I'm glad that Sergeant Munley was a warrior in that moment. But I also recognize the risks in going too far. Walk through, you know, the infantry, based on its the mission itself is that close combat to close with and destroy the enemy. It's a very up close, personal, very much warrior action. And so when you're working a counterinsurgency fight, say for instance in Ramadi, Iraq, that you have to be able to also have the switch of being a guardian, also able to have a different mindset, and to actually tamp down some of those warrior instincts. But definitely when the moment arises, when the enemy chooses to engage, then yeah, we're going to play this out. We're going to win this fight. And those razor teeth are going to come out, as I remember one leader talking about it, and we're going to win. And so I think that it's a, I don't know that balance is the right word, but there's a sense of a dichotomy there of a, you know, of some complementary aspects of police work that, that really evokes both warrior and guardian. So that's me looking in. As a profession, I think law enforcement needs to have those kind of conversations, and not for the sake of just having, you know, fun arguments or useless arguments that don't go anywhere, but to really be passionate to say, this is why I believe it, but then to be able to listen to the other side of it, and to really be able to try to understand how do these things interact together. So that's where, you know, in terms of warriors and guardians, in terms of the course, of how I want to bring people into the conversation. And then I want to build on that to talk about just some of the things we're talking about right now. Like, what does it mean to be a profession? Does it even matter that we understand it? Obviously, I think it matters, but that's worth discussing, right? And then walking through what it means to be part of a profession, and then, you know, like the tail end of keepers of the profession, the sense of stewardship. What does it mean to be responsible for this, to pass this on? And so for me, I want to build off that warrior and guardian conversation, the argument, the debate, and build that into a deeper understanding of, like, what does it really mean to be who we are as a law enforcement profession?
Excellent. And I think those discussions and dialogue and debate to clarify rather than vilify one term or the other, and understand the complementary aspects, as you said, that there was an event in California that Roy Bethke and I were at back in October, and with some of the top executives from law enforcement agencies in California. And that's the comment that they made when they were asked about that, that the two terms are not exclusive. We need that guardian mindset and the warrior skill set, the guardian mindset and the warrior spirit, that there's a time such as the active killer events that you've talked about in San Bernardino and Orlando and all of these events that we've seen where people need to step up and flip that switch and be able to step into that other role. So you, in addition to decades of leadership experience, you're also a trainer. You're a consultant and you're a trainer. You've been involved in training. So what advice would you have to trainers that are listening to help get this message across about being professionals, about embracing the elements of being a profession? What's some piece of advice from all your training experience that you would have for trainers?
Yeah, you know, I think trainers are in just this incredibly potent position. There's incredible leverage there to be able to influence the law enforcement profession as a whole. You know, when you have a block of instruction, no matter what it is, no matter what topic you're covering, you've got people's attention, right? And you've got this ability to make a huge impact. You know, and we can talk just about, you know, childhood and youth development, of how often we look back and we say, well, this particular teacher or coach or somebody that was in my life really had this impact. And trainers are in that kind of position to be able to do that. And they can hold that almost sacred obligation very meaningfully. And I think that one of the biggest things is to first wrestle with some of these things themselves, to do some journaling, to do reflective thinking, to study the topic of what does it mean for me as a trainer to be part of this profession, and really at this point to be a steward of the profession, trying to pass on some of the very critical things about it. How do I continue to grow? And then how do I help others to grow? And so I think really the first thing is that the trainers who are listening is to take a very proactive, very deliberate approach to growing as a professional yourself, and to growing in understanding what it means to be a profession. Then you have a base to start to really include it in all classes as a point of conversation. And so I think just some of the things to do maybe in an actual class first is just to talk about it, right? To open up the conversation, just like you and I are doing right now, to say, are you a professional? Okay, well, why? What is it about being a professional? When the Army was going through some of that self-analysis on being a professional, one of the quotes that came out was by someone who was discouraged about the Army as a profession. They said, "How can I be a professional when there isn't any profession?" Right, and it was a profound statement for that particular leader, and so giving the opportunities, giving the forums for some of those conversations to happen, you know, whether or not it's a whole course, a half day, it could just be a 15-minute lunch or even lead-in conversation. Let's talk about what it means to be professionals. I think the second thing would be giving people permission, and what I mean by that is that oftentimes, in work in general, and I think even more so in some of the kinds of profession like military and law enforcement, we're going around. We've got this bravado in what we do. There's this need to be on top of things and task oriented and aggressive, and sometimes it literally takes someone giving permission to say, "Hey, just you can pause for a minute and let's crack open our crusty or our hard shell exteriors and let's talk about what's going on inside. You know, why is it that you get up and do this job? Why is it that you wanted to swear an oath and get into this profession in the first place? Let's go back to some of those initial motivations. Let's go back to some of the things that make you tick." And it's amazing when you give people permission to talk about those things, you give them a space to do that, they do. And it's amazing what you learn about the people that open up. It's amazing what all of us learn about one another. And it's powerful to kind of reset some of that mindset, of reset what it really means. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? And talk about some of those deeper issues. So I would say just giving the space, even just talking about it, having the conversation. I would say giving people permission to open up, encouraging people to journal, you know, even if it's just a line or two with some regularity about what's going on. And then going back to something you said earlier of talking about some of the positive things. I think studying some of the heroic stories of people in our profession, whether it's physical courage or in particular moral courage. I read an article a long time ago in the magazine Fast Company. It was on the topic of what is courage. And one of the things the author said, they quoted the psalmist in saying, "We become what we behold." We become what we behold. We become what we look at. We become what we meditate on, what we think about. And so studying those heroic stories, and not necessarily the ones that are in headlines, but those heroic stories that are happening all the time around us. Let's pause for a minute, talk about it, celebrate that heroism, that courage that that particular officer did. Let's try to get rid of some of the cynicism that's there, because that, unfortunately, that often accompanies it, right? That just is kind of, I guess, who we are as humans. So study the heroic stories, and I would say start provocative conversations. Warriors versus Guardians is one of those. I know there's some, folks who are great at starting some of those just controversial, provocative conversations. You know, Lou Hayes comes to mind as one. Get people talking, because that's exactly what professionals should do. When someone's an expert in their profession, they should be having energetic, disagreement-based conversations, debates with their fellow professionals to try to, like you said, get to better understanding and clarification, rather than vilification, but actually having those very lively, disagreeable sometimes conversations. So those are just a few of the things trainers can do.
Excellent. Some powerful points. And I think it's really powerful when you talk about that sacred obligation and that we are stewards of the profession. And it's, I'm just reading a book right now called Legacy, which, as a former rugby player, it's about the All Blacks and rebuilding of the New Zealand All Blacks rugby team. But one of the things that they embraced was a philosophy, was the legacy of the jersey, leaving the jersey and leaving the All Blacks team and the organization better when you left than it was when you came in. And I think that's part of that sacred obligation for trainers to be stewards of the profession, leave the profession better because we were here. And as you said, give people permission to talk about and go back to their why, because we have these this why that drives us into this profession, and sometimes we lose focus of that. And then, as you say, we need to study the heroic stories, because there's so many of those heroic stories out there. Now, if people want to get a hold of you, Jamie, to get more information, or wanted to go and look at hosting your seminar, or bringing you in as a consultant, what's the best way to get a hold of you or get more information?
Sure, absolutely. The best way probably is just email, and the best email to use would be Jamie, and that's J-A-M, as in Mike, E-Y, @ OutsiderConsulting.com. So that's Jamie Ghidorie @ OutsiderConsulting.com. And I'll give my phone number as well. Forewarned, I usually let it go to voicemail if I don't know the number, so no surprises there. But definitely reach me on my mobile at 254-317-9951. So Jamie @ OutsiderConsulting.com, or 254-231-7951.
Excellent. And there's information on the seminar that Jamie teaches, Warriors and Guardians, Keeping Our Profession, at virtusleadership.com. So, Jamie, I want to thank you. I know you're a busy man. You have a lot of things on the go with your education, your family, your consulting. But I want to thank you for making the time today. But more importantly, I want to thank you for everything that you've done, for your leadership, for your training, for your message, the work that you've done to inspire us to embrace the concept of a profession and being professionals, and the work that you have done and the work that you continue to do to enhance our profession and continue to serve us and to build more leaders. And for all of that, I truly want to thank you for everything that you have done, everything that you continue to do.
And Brian, I appreciate that, and thank you to you as well for the service that you've done, and then as you continue to develop and train other leaders, a lot of respect for all that you're doing, and thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you for that, and I would encourage people, Jamie talked today about identity. I would encourage people to go to the website experiencewinx.com, click on the link for the 2015 talks, and watch Jamie's talk at the 2015 WinX event on identity. It's a powerful talk on identity. Did an amazing job with it, and I would encourage people to go and watch that. So for members of the Excellence in Training Academy community, I would encourage you now that you've listened to this to spend some time to reflect on what are your biggest takeaways. Jamie provided a lot of key information for us on what it means to be a professional and the key elements of a profession, the role of identity. And so I would encourage you to spend some time to reflect on the key takeaways, your key takeaways, and then to identify at least one action item. What action are you going to take as a result of the information that Jamie provided? Because if you just consume the information and fail to take action, then it's not going to help to move our profession forward, and we're dropping our role as stewards of this profession. So for members of the Excellence in Training Academy, thank you for your continued commitment to excellence in and through training, and continue to train hard, train safe, train smart, and always be willing to dare to be great.